Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the education story when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms, but what is it that government is doing to produce, prepare, or deliver for which it gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the guy in the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on that pizza that they have to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and pay rent on the store that you sit in and eat it? Why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we all buy? If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Tax and status is available on compact disc. That's our home school. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do that right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, last time we took a look at this thing of a test or the quality of education between 1895 and today. If you'd like a copy of that test, just send me a stamped, self-addressed envelope. I'll copy it for you and send it to you in your envelope. I thought that was quite an eye-opener. I'm an old man. I couldn't pass that test. My grandmother passed it in 1895 when she was in the eighth grade. I took a look at it. I couldn't pass it. And she told me that she knew more in the eighth grade than I did as a high school senior and a graduate from high school. My grandfather only went to the sixth grade. That's about where Henry Ford went, sixth grade. Thomas Edison only went to the third grade. Now, these people were not dumb, and when we say they only went to the sixth grade, that doesn't mean that that's where their education ceased. You know, I'm an old man, but I learn something new every day. I'm always reading and looking and studying and paying attention and making my observations. I'm an educator, and I like to educate other people to what I know, and I like to learn from other people what they know. I don't know it all yet. I'm still learning. But I was amazed at the level of understanding and educational background or the educational achievement that the eighth graders had in 1895. Far surpasses anything that we know today, anything that I knew back in the 1950s, anything my dad knew back in the 1930s. There has been a progressive degeneration in the educational level of students and citizens, the people of the United States of America, and I suspect that it's been that way for a long time worldwide. Now, if you'd like to make a change, do something different, there's no better time than the present. Now, sometimes we point the finger at the educational institutions, such as the principals or the administrators of the school district or the school system, and we say it's their fault. There is a built-in system here. It's expensive, it's built-in, and it's not changeable. As I speak, there's a lady in Washington, D.C., a Korean woman. She's been given the task of reforming the school system in Washington, D.C. There's an attempt being made to reform the school system since Hurricane Katrina down in New Orleans. They will both fail. In the ultimate analysis, they will both fail because failure is built into the system. The system is designed in such a way that it cannot be reformed. Let me repeat that in case you missed it. The educational system in America is designed to be fail-safe, and no one will be able to reform it. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but the defense industry is designed the same way. We're now spending $500 billion a year on education, $500 billion a year on defense. Both of these systems, these institutions, are designed in such a way that they cannot be reformed. Period. End of report. Our economic system is designed the same way. When it was designed in such a way, with the laws in place. For instance, the Federal Reserve cannot be audited. And the powers that are given to the Federal Reserve are not reserved to the Congress or to the President. There's nothing the President or the Congress can do to stop the Federal Reserve. They've already got the power. It's in place. It was designed that way so that if in the future there was an honest attempt by Americans and American citizens to reform these institutions, they would be stopped cold in their tracks. So let me show you how the education system works, since that's the one that we're talking about right now. Let's suppose that you wanted to reform the New York City school system. There's been much talk about that. Mayor Bloomberg said that one of his top priorities would be to reform the New York school system. Many mayors, many politicians have said it needs reforming. We've got to do it. We've got to do it for our children. But it hasn't been done yet. It isn't going to be done, and that's because it can't be done. It has the fail-safe failure mode already built into it. Now, you don't need to stay in the failure mode. You can leave anytime you want. But many people have it in their minds that what we need to do is to reform it. Well, one problem with policymakers is that they insist upon making policy, and perhaps nowhere is this more of a problem than in public education. Now, a recent study by Common Good of Law and Regulations affecting a typical New York high school is the latest example. The study found that more than 60 sources of law and regulations, including thousands of provisions, applying to a New York City high school. These include New York State's more than 800-page school law, 720 pages of regulations from the State Commissioner of Education, more than 15,000 decisions in 43 volumes of the Commissioner's Office, and the 204-page teacher union contract with the district, the nearly 700-page No Child Left Behind Act, and more than 200 pages of regulations just concerning student discipline. Did you hear that? Now, that's a total of 17,624 pages. Now, that's just the regulations, laws, rules, and union contract concerning the New York City schools. So let's suppose we have an incompetent teacher and we want to get rid of that teacher. Impossible. Can't be done. Period. End of report. You might say, what if that teacher murders a student? Okay. Yeah, you can get rid of that one. Not because of any systematic modality in the law concerning the schools, but because if the teacher is convicted and sent to jail, that teacher cannot teach from his or her jail cell, so therefore a substitute teacher has to be brought in, and therefore you have effectively removed that teacher, but not by any modality concerning school or the school system. Now, it is true if you have a bad teacher and that teacher dies of a heart attack, you can get rid of that teacher simply because the teacher is dead. But not by any modality that's in New York law, regulations, rules, customs, uses, and practices by which you could fire that teacher. That isn't going to happen. So that's why I said in Washington, D.C., they got the same thing there, and they got the same thing in Chicago, Los Angeles, and so on. It might be a few pages different, and they might call it by a different time, term, or title. But the teachers' unions, the NEA, has an absolute stranglehold over the process. The policymakers in the legislatures and executive branches of government are from the Dewey School. Hell, they're from the Gatto School. Those are the people who want to dumb down your children. They're the ones that are in power. You're not going to remove them. They put into place a fail-safe system. They can die. They can be removed from office, but you're not going to change anything. It's kind of like President Obama. He has some ideas that he would like to put into place, but President Bush has already initiated the fail-safe operation, and his hands are tied, and there's nothing he can do about it. And when President Obama leaves office, he'll do the same thing. The next president's hands will be tied, and he won't be able to do what he wants to do because President Obama will have already put the fail-safe institution into effect. And so you're not going to make any of these changes. But there's more to come. Not only do we have 17,624 pages of material that the teachers can all duck behind and hide, there are 65 steps are involved in suspending a disruptive student. See, let's suppose you got a kid that comes in, like out in Colorado. Two kids come in, and they shoot up the school, and they kill a bunch of students. Okay. If you wanted to suspend one of those students from school because he came in with a gun and he was shooting people, you'd have to go through 65 steps to suspend him. Now, I suppose that for shooting some of the other students, we would probably spend the time to go through those 65 steps. But picture that, 65 elements to getting rid of a disruptive student. 83 steps in firing a teacher. You could have a teacher over here who's as dumb as a box of rocks and maybe as a pervert and one thing and another, but hey, you got to go through 85 steps to fire him. Now somebody's going to say, well, what if we arrested him because he's a pervert and we prosecuted him and convicted him and we sent him off to jail? Well, that isn't firing him. All that means is that he failed to show up at work, and when he fails to show up at work, we're going to replace him with a substitute teacher until his tenure runs out, and then he will be terminated under the rules. But it didn't have anything to do with the rules themselves. It has to be an outside force that comes in here. He has to be arrested and jailed on some kind of a charge, or die from old age or heart attack. There are 38 steps that you have to go through to fill a teacher vacancy, 99 steps in replacing a heating system, another 99 steps in conducting an athletic event, including the size of the ear flaps that the athletes are wearing on their uniforms. There are 35 steps in suspending a special education student, and some of these steps and procedures can take years to resolve. Even then, such as an attempt to fire a teacher, may cost more than $100,000 and still not be successful. So you could spend $100,000 going through 83 steps in firing a teacher, and it could take 5 years or more, and when you get all through, you've spent $100,000 and failed. So the logical thing to do is to promote this person up out of your way. And this is why in our public school system, it's top-heavy with bureaucracy. The school system in America has 66%. That's two-thirds of the money being spent is on administration. And that's because every time you have an incompetent administrator and you need to get the job done, you promote him up and out of the way so that he can spend his days in his office shuffling paper and pinching girls on the butt down at the water cooler so that the rest of us can go to work and get done what has to be done. You don't get rid of them, you promote them out of your way. And so all of that costs money. Now, I know it's stupid and I know it's insane, but that's the way the game is played. Now, New York State is not alone. Nor is New York State at the top of the list in bureaucratic complexities. Indiana's school code at 1,250 pages a few years ago is now more than 50% longer than New York's. California's code has more than 9,000 pages and its 11 volumes are said to weigh more than 40 pounds. It includes such essential details as stipulating football uniforms must be sterilized at least once a year, and districts may use armored vehicles to transport money to banks, and prohibiting parents from helping paint or clean public schools without union permission. So if a bunch of volunteers said, we want to go over to this public school and we want to paint it and clean it up, they couldn't do it without the union's permission because that infringes on union workers. We don't want that. It's been reported that Pennsylvania's suburban school district superintendents must comply with 1,027 mandates, 70% of which are unfunded. So a few years ago, then-Governor George Voinovich said that school administrators in that state spend as much as 50% of their time filling out federal forms, which account for only 6% of the education spending. Now think about that. In Pennsylvania, in Ohio here, the ex-governor, Voinovich, said that the school administrators in that state spend 50% of their time filling out federal forms. And when they get through filling out the federal forms, they receive 6% of their school budget from the federal government. I had a student in here one time, and he was a coin dealer, that's what he was, and he had a coin store up in Cleveland, Ohio. And here's what his dilemma was. He had a lot of government bureaucrats coming into his store, raising hell with him and making demands upon his time and upon his facilities and all. And he got kind of bummed out. Well, come to find out, that store represented about 10% of his total sales for the year. 90% of his sales were made to people like me in their private homes, where he comes over with an attaché case with a number of coins in it. And then the customer at home goes through the coins in the, you know, privacy of his own office or his own den. And here's the coin dealer, and he's got the coins, and I'm looking at the coins, and we're in the privacy of my own home. And that represented 90% of his sales. So 90% of his sales are being done with about 10% of his time. And 10% of his sales are being completed with 90% of his time. So it didn't take us long to figure out that you need to close your store in Cleveland and spend 100% of your time catering to the customers that buy the majority or the most of your product, which is private buyers in the privacy of their own home, or maybe over a napkin down at Jake's Bar and Grill. And that's what he did and solved his problem. Now, the school system is running just exactly like that. When you look at 50% of your time, effort, and energy being spent to collect 6% of your revenue, don't you think it's time to drop that 6% and concentrate on something more productive? So going on, the U.S. Department of Education itself has said that its requirements result in 48.6 million man-hours of paperwork annually. That's the equivalent of 25,000 full-time employees. So now the Department of Education comes forward and they say, well, yeah, it's true. The U.S. Department of Education itself has said that the requirements that they have mandated upon the schools results in 25,000 full-time employees filling out all those papers. Now, if our objective, like President Obama, is to create jobs for the express purpose of putting paychecks into people's pockets so that they can go out and spend them and stimulate the economy, that's a hell of a good way to do that. But if our objective here is to employ people in productive and meaningful work, producing goods and services that you and I both want, then it's just a waste of time, effort, and energy, and particularly money. Now there's more. Last year it was said journalist Eleanor Burkett estimated that a typical school principal faces 470,000 federal, state, and local regulations. That's 470,000. If her estimate is even remotely accurate, the result is a regulatory absurdity, an administrative impossibility. No one could possibly even be aware of so many obligations. And furthermore, policymakers continually making policy means that at any given time, many, perhaps thousands, of these regulations are in the process of being amended, deleted, added to, or otherwise changed. So as someone once said about government in general, there are so many laws and regulations that all of us are continually breaking, some of them without being aware that we're doing so or in what context it may exist. This is assuredly so of public school boards and staffs. And none of this even includes case law, the result of an ever-increasing volume of court decisions, all of which would be bad enough if such detail had a positive effect, but what the late James S. Coleman and his colleagues concluded more than 40 years ago is likely to still be true today. In a 1966 report, they said that they could not find any educational policy or strategy that ensured student achievement. Now, as former Xerox chairman David T. Kearns and Dennis P. Doyle wrote in their 1988 work, Winning the Brain Race. The truth is, they said, that prospective rules and regulations are necessary only if there are no measurable performance objectives. Once there are performance objectives and standards, then schools can be encouraged to do it their way. Now, let's think about this for a second. There's a system in place. It takes 2/3 of all the money that goes into it just to feed its administrators. There is a legal system that surrounds it that requires 17,624 pages of material. And of the 17,000 pages of material plus, there isn't anybody that's ever read it, not all of it. And it is such a mess that in the final analysis, you can't get rid of a troubled, unruly student or a lazy, incompetent teacher. Just can't be done. So much for reform. Now, it's fairly simple to simply pack up, move out, and go do your own thing. That doesn't take a whole lot. But to reform the public school system, which is what nearly everybody has in mind, we see the problems with the public school system, and then we say, well, we've got to fix that. And you've been in the process of trying to fix that now for 100 years, and you haven't fixed it yet, and you're not going to. And you're not going to because there are new problems that constantly come up and new laws, rules, and regulations that are constantly being put into the operation. And it's being done for the express purpose of stifling your attempt to reform it. It's there so that it cannot be reformed. That's the bottom line. Now let's take a look at something else here. There's a notable number of people in our society that have been homeschooled, you know, past tense. Well, who are some of these people who have been homeschooled? Celebrities, people that are pretty famous. And what kind of an outcome did we see with that, or with their education? Well, a fellow by the name of Ansel Adams, who lived from 1902 to 1984, he was arguably the greatest photographer of the 20th century. At age 12, when he was unable to stand the confinement and tedium of the classroom, he totally disrupted his lessons with wild laughter and undisguised contempt for the inept ramblings of his teachers. So his father decided that Ansel's formal education was best ended. And from that point on, the boy was homeschooled in Greek, the English classics, algebra, and the glories of the ocean, inlets, and rocky beaches that surround their home every year, or very near San Francisco. Ansel Adams. Okay, there's one. John Adams, the second president of the United States. John Adams was taught to read at home, and then happily went for lessons with a handful of children, taught in the kitchen of a neighbor woman. And it was considered, he was considered fit for college, and then proceeded to Harvard at age 15. John Adams, second president of the United States, homeschooled, went to Harvard at age 15. Now, that's quite an achievement, wouldn't you say? Now, we have John Quincy Adams, John Adams' son, Louisa May Alcott, Alan Alda, the actor, Alcott Bronson, or Bronson Alcott, I'm not quite sure. I guess it's Louisa May Alcott and Bronson Alcott, her father, self-educated, Wilson Bentley, and Agatha Christie, Edward Curtis, Eric Demain, Thomas Edison, Paul Erdos, Benjamin Franklin, the Gutterson family, C.S. Lewis, Abraham Lincoln, Todd Ludwig, Countess Augusta Ada Lovelace, Margaret Mead, and Yehudi Menuhin. Yehudi Menuhin. Not bad, huh? Now, that's a bunch of pretty famous names. Homeschooled, Frank Lloyd Wright, Virginia Woolf, Andrew Wythe, Jamie Wythe, Gloria Steinem. Remember the feminist writer and co-founder of Ms. Magazine? I don't know if that's a feather in her cap or not, but she was homeschooled. All right, now there's some famous names. Now, homeschooling spells success. Homeschooling spells success. Listen to this. Came from CBN News. Homeschoolers aren't immersed in a structured classroom setting amidst dozens of other students. Most of them don't even have credentialed teachers or state-approved curricula. But homeschoolers, Evan O'Dorney and Caitlin Snaring, don't feel deprived. In fact, their education at home has given them the freedom and passion to pursue the thing that they love to do most, and that is to learn. Homeschoolers swept this year's Scripps National Spelling Bee and the National Geographic Spelling Bee. And even though homeschoolers represent about 3% of this nation's students, they comprise nearly 13%, or 36, of the 286 contestants in this year's National Spelling Bee. Did you know that? Now, that's roughly 13%. 13%. They represent 3% of the population, but they take 13% of the honors. Now, why is that? Home school is a superior model to the public school system. That's what that boils down to. It's a better model. Well, I got to give you a reminder here, if I can find my paper. Here it is. Mid-course reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967 and asking for it. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. And these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the education story. Now, education comes in three forms here in the United States. Public school, that's number one, about 50 million students. Parochial school, that's number two, about 3 million students. And home school, about the same, 3 million students. Or about 56 million students being educated here in the United States. We have a compulsory education law here in this country. We have to educate these children. But we have three choices. The state promotes choice number one, public school. Churches promote choice number two, that is parochial school. And choice number three is promoted by no one. That's called homeschool. Well, the public school officials and the NEA and Congress and the legislatures are not going to promote homeschool. That's because they've got their own product to sell. Now remember, every child educated in the public school system, on average in the United States, costs $55 a day. Every day, day in and day out. 180 days a year, $55. Parochial school costs $15 a day, day in and day out. But homeschool is the champion. It only costs $3.33 a day and gives by far and away the better educational quality for the money spent and for the time invested. $3.33 a day to score at the 86th percentile on average. It's $15 a day to score at the 80th percentile, and it's $55 in public school to score at the 50th percentile, and it costs $17,000 a year. Let's see how much that is a day. $17,000 a year divided by, we have 180 days in the school year. That's $94.44. That's pushing $100 a day. $100 a day. And then, if we can get this kid, if we can get this kid on Ritalin, you know, if we can get him in some kind of a handicap program, then they make double that. And that's what the name of the game is. It's how much money can we milk from the government and from the taxpayers. Now, homeschooling spells success. Listen to this story here. Homeschoolers, even Evan O'Dorney and Caitlin Snarling, don't feel deprived by being homeschooled. In fact, their education at home has given them the freedom and passion to pursue the thing they love to do the most, and that is to learn. But listen to this. Homeschoolers swept this year's Scripps National Spelling Bee and the National Geographic Spelling Bee. Even though homeschoolers only represent about 3% of this nation's students, they comprise nearly 13% or 36 of the 286 contestants in this year's National Spelling Bee. Now, what's more, first, second, and third place also went to homeschoolers in 2000, with one winning the bee the following year as well. Now, they've been in the top 10 every year this decade. Now, this year's favorite homeschooler, his name is Samir Patel, S-A-M-I-R, Samir Patel, appeared in his fifth consecutive spelling bee. But Samir, ended up giving way to another homeschooler, Evan O'Dorney of Danville, California. And like many homeschoolers, Evan pursues his passions without the restrictions that his traditionally schooled peers face in a standardized instruction. This young fella is by no means your one-dimensional dictionary worm. Among his many talents, the child prodigy enjoys composing piano concertos and studies classical music at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Evan's instrument of choice is the piano because it allows him to play a number of notes simultaneously. And he said, "I like it because I'm hearing chords in my head and I can get it all out," said the champion. Jeffrey O'Dorney helped prepare her son for the contest by going over Latin roots and complex words from the dictionary. But spelling isn't the only thing that triggers Evan's interest. He's like a sponge. Early on, he always wanted to learn more and more, she said. He is so fun to be with and to work with. And despite his tendency for putting letters together, this gifted 13-year-old has an even greater passion for numbers. His eyes beamed brightly when he shared about his upcoming summer math camp at the University of California at Berkeley calculus class. Homeschoolers are not social introverts. it's been alleged that they don't have social contacts, and therefore they're probably going to turn into loners and be social misfits. Oh, no. No. The social misfits are in public school, who have contact with other social misfits, which is where they learn how to become these social misfits. When people are educated at home, they're around adults or peers in small numbers that are their age or thereabouts, like brothers and sisters or cousins. They develop in a family atmosphere, and they turn out to be better adjusted and more socially open than the school or the public school educated students. Now, here's a showcase of talent. Spelling bees provide an avenue for homeschoolers to demonstrate their academic merit against traditionally schooled students. In a competitive situation like a spelling bee, children can measure their skills, and it gives them some sort of concrete feeling of accomplishment. Or so says the Cato Institute education researcher Andrew Colson. Now, 12-year-old Josiah Wright of North Carolina has a love for both spelling and homeschooling. Now, the formidable competitor who won against the regional B touts Huma something or other as his favorite word, which is a fish found in Hawaii. You spell it H-U-M-U-H-U-M-U-N-U-K-U-P-A-A as his favorite word. I can't pronounce it, I can't say it, and I can barely spell it, looking at it right on the page. It's the name of a fish found in Hawaii. Now, Josiah's mother doesn't give him any special spelling training because she has her hands full with three younger adopted children. They've been diagnosed with Down syndrome, and they also have a 2-year-old daughter. Now, I have never taught him spelling, said Ann. We never sat down and said I before E except after C. Every year we would go through the spelling words provided in the curriculum, and he would just nail them down. So if there's anyone who appreciates the opportunity to learn from home, it's going to be Josiah. I can finish my schoolwork early rather than be stuck in a classroom for several hours a day, said the spelling whiz, who noted another perk. He said, no bullies. Another homeschooler, 12-year-old Rebecca of Virginia, whose mother organized a local homeschooling spelling bee trained for this year's big event. She said, I study one-on-one and with my mom a lot, Rebecca said, and she calls out the words and I spell them and put them into my computer so that I can study them later. Now, an extra instructional time, or the extra instructional time, allows Rebecca to apportion 2.5 hours a day to her spelling daily, while leaving more than adequate time for other objects or subjects to pursue. Now, you can't drop history and math and study spelling all day, Rebecca's mom said, but we finish with a subject and then we move on to the next one. And you don't have to wait for 30 kids to get finished. Regional Spelling Bee champion, Florida's Justin Murdoch, also sees the advantages of homeschooling. He said, I don't miss going to school with the other kids, the 12-year-old said. I can do my schoolwork really fast if I'm by myself and then have a whole lot of time to do my spelling. And who says that learning isn't fun? Sometimes I catch myself making up words using what I know about prefixes and suffixes, Justin said. And then I look them up in a dictionary to see if they're real words. Now, homeschoolers also know their geography. Redmond, Washington's, Caitlin, Snarling, won this year's National Geographic Spelling Bee in the nation's capital on May 23rd. Now, the relentless 14-year-old answered every question correctly during the two-day competition. Caitlin's vigorous homeschool routine lets her allot 4 to 6 hours a day to geography. And the devoted competitor can even be seen studying after church at her mother's baseball games and in her bed with a flashlight. I had a kid like that. She'd go to bed at night and she'd stay up until 2 or 3 in the morning or until the battery ran dead in her flashlight. Once children get on to learning, they will teach themselves. Now, I just wanted to point out that the spelling bee, the two big ones here in the United States, are dominated now by homeschoolers. Now, let me give you some names here, pretty famous people. You know, people like John Adams, second president of the United States. That's one, homeschooled. Joseph Pulitzer. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize. Pulitzer Prizes, they're given to journalists, newspaper writers typically, editorial writers and so on. People that write books. James A. Michener was a Pulitzer Prize winner. All right, Ansel Adams, Robert Frost, Irving Berlin, Whoopi Goldberg, William F. Buckley Jr., Andrew Carnegie, Charlie Chaplin, Agatha Christie, Winston Churchill, Charles Dickens, Thomas Edison, Benjamin Franklin, Florence Nightingale, Woodrow Wilson, the Wright brothers, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Alexander Graham Bell, and Pearl Buck. Now that's quite a little who's who of homeschooling success. We got John Adams, a president, Joseph Pulitzer, a writer, Ansel Adams, I believe was a photographer, Robert Frost, a poet, Irving Berlin, a songwriter, Whoopi Goldberg, a comedian. William F. Buckley Jr. was an editor. Andrew Carnegie, a businessman. Charlie Chaplin, an actor. Agatha Christie, a book writer. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain. Charles Dickens, a writer. Thomas Edison, an inventor. Benjamin Franklin, an old-timey patriot in the, it's one of the old founding fathers. Florence Nightingale, the founder of the Red Cross. Woodrow Wilson, who was president of the United States. And the Wright brothers. Yeah, the Wright brothers, the guys that invented the airplane. Franklin D. Roosevelt. Alexander Graham Bell. Pearl Buck. Now, that's quite a who's who. General George S. Patton. Joan of Arc. Leonardo da Vinci, Wolfgang Mozart, Felix Mendelssohn, Claude Monet, William Penn, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Robert E. Lee, Douglas MacArthur, C.S. Lewis, Hans Christian Andersen, Mark Twain, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, John Paul Jones, Vanessa and Serena Williams, the two tennis stars. And let's see, some of these names I'm going to skip over because they're not that noteworthy. Like Liz Krobroth, Elisa Brooker. Never heard of them. See what else we got here. Whoopi Goldberg, I named her. All right, now these people have made names for themselves. They're pretty famous people. They have been in politics, Some of them are in films. Some of them are comedians and other things. These are not people that are social misfits. These aren't people that have been left behind, you know, kind of figuratively speaking, when they're talking about the rapture, you know, talking about education here. These people haven't been left behind in society. They're right out in the forefront. These people are the leaders and the movers and the shakers, or were. Now let's take a look at socialization. There's quite a claim that, well, if your child is homeschooled, he'll end up being a social misfit. Listen to this. It was Theodore Roosevelt who said, "To educate a man in mind and not in morals is to educate a menace to society." To educate a man in mind and not to educate him in morals is to create a menace to society. That's what the public school system does. It educates their minds without any morals, and they make menaces to society. And just look at Columbine High School as one example out of many. Two boys who are educated in mind but not in morals. Many homeschoolers share this sentiment when it comes to public school, believing that the moral relativism, violence, peer pressure, drugs, and promiscuity found inside their gates provide an inadequate setting to properly socialize their children. And yet 92% of superintendents believe that home learners are emotionally unstable, deprived of proper social development, and too judgmental of the world around them. Now that's according to a California study by researcher Dr. Brian Ray. So what makes homeschool socialization such a hot topic? Well, with approximately 4 million children currently being homeschooled in the United States, along with a 15 to 20% yearly growth rate, many professional educators and school boards are concerned that this exodus will keep funds from entering the public education system. So many teachers also believe that a successful home instruction by uncredentialed parents undermines their expertise and jeopardizes their jobs. Questions about inadequate socialization are often brought up as a means to disqualify homeschooling as a viable alternative or a form of education. But are the arguments valid? Well, a look at the research on this socialization debate shines further light on the issue. There's no place like home. So why is there such a dichotomy in the socialization experience between homeschoolers and conventional students? Well, it all has to do with the learning environment. The National Home Education Research Institute disclosed that the 36 to 54 hours that students spend in school related weekly activities make peers and adults outside of the home the primary influences in children's lives. Their primary influence is not their parents. Very important point. When you send your child off to public school, then the people that he is associating with become his peers, mentors, and educators, not you. Students who are educated at home are not being educated or exposed to drugs, violence, and immorality, and backseat sex. So if you're opposed to that, then start thinking about homeschool. Realizing the harm that this constant exposure can produce, especially if it's not countered by involved parenting, most homeschoolers are well aware of their children's need for close one-to-one contact throughout the education process. Jesus understood the importance of continual intimate contact with his students. As he ate, slept, worked, fellowshipped with his disciples 24 hours a day, and it's unlikely that Jesus would have entrusted their training to total strangers. So how do these different settings affect children? Well, Dr. Thomas Smedley believes that homeschoolers have superior socialization skills, and his research supports his claim. He conducted a study in which he administered the Vineyard Adaptive Behavior Scales, a test to identify mature and well-adapted behaviors in children. Some learners ranked in the 84th percentile compared to public school students, who were drastically lower in the 23rd. So welcome to the real world. Many school socialization advocates argue that homeschooling precludes children from experiencing real life. Instead of being locked behind school gates in what some would consider an artificial setting characterized by bells, forced silence, and age segregation, homeschooled children frequently extend their everyday classroom to fire departments, hospitals, museums, repair shops, city halls, national parks, churches and colleges, where real community interaction and real community contacts are made. So dismantling the stereotype that home learners spend their days isolated from society at kitchen tables with workbooks in hand. Reports are that they actually participate in approximately 5 different social activities outside the home on a regular basis. Furthermore, researcher Dr. Linda Montgomery found that 78% of high school home learners were employed with paying jobs, while a majority engaged in volunteering and community service. And research presented at the National Christian Home Educators Leadership Conference divulged that homeschool graduates far exceeded their public and private school counterparts in college by ranking the highest in 42 of 63 indicators of collegiate success. They were also ranked as being superior in 4 out of 5 achievement categories, including socialization, as they were assessed as being the most charismatic and influential. Think about that. When they're actually tested, we find that homeschooled children are better and that they are socially adjusted and better socially adjusted than their counterparts in the public school. They're able to go out, buy, sell, trade, make change, work, and on average have 5 outside contacts per day with stores, businesses, and other people, tradesmen. They're not locked away and sequestered in the public school enterprise, which is really, in real fact, socially debilitating, as is evidenced by Columbine and the public school shootings and the violence and the sexual escapades and the drugs that we find in public school, that we don't find in parochial schools where we teach morality and in home schools where we teach socialization and morality. No, the truth of the matter is homeschool produces a superior product to the educational environment of the public schools. Hey, I'm about out of time. I got to remind you again here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.